There was just so much courage and bravery and hardship and suffering and trauma and terror that was all intermixed at that time. You know, my parents today, if you talk to them, they never vilify Arabs. They never demonize Muslims. In fact, my mother will tell you one of her best friends was a Muslim girl. And when my mother was having to escape, they all went through different routes. She went to her and they never exchange any words, but they just knew. And they sat with each other and cried because they knew that they would never have that friendship again. It's just, it's so sad what happens to humanity. Mm. And I think, like, look at their courage and look at how my parents, all that they suffered, and it would be justified. And I work with so many trauma survivors. It would be justified for them to be so angry and hateful. Mm. But, you know, you're swallowing the poison. If yeah. you're one swallowing the poison, hoping that the other person would die, it's just toxic. Yeah. That's only going to harm you.
Welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words. I'm your co-host, Judy Alexander, and I'm here with my husband, Dr. Bruce Chalmer.
Oh, hello, Judy. Hello, viewers and listeners. Our topic for today is
genocide, optimism, and belly dancing. An interview with Dr. Emily Basha and the Honorable Paul Johnson.
You are in for a treat, folks. I say that with a lot of our guests because it's true. And this is another one. What a fascinating mm-hmm. couple.
Yes, they are.
And I just love picking that title. Genocide, that's awful. Yeah. Optimism, well, that's good. Mm-hmm. And belly dancing. Yes, you're going to have to watch to find out what the connection is. They're all in there. And these are just two amazing people, and I won't bother trying to introduce them because we're introducing them when we get to the video.
We have an introduction coming up.
We do. So before we get to that, we just want to take care of a little business here. First mm-hmm. of all, let's put in a plug for the books that start, the book that started this and all the other books that I've written. So go ahead and tell about two of them anyway.
Okay, well, the book that started is Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy and How to Get It Back. And then there was the next book, It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy is Wrong.
Indeed. And I'm going to mention a couple other books I've written briefly.
The little bonus books.
Little bonus books. One mm-hmm. of them you get for free when you sign up for my newsletter, which you can do right from, you'll see it up above us when you watch, if those of you watching the video, right from ctin7.com. That is our podcast website. You can sign up for Dr. Chalmers newsletter. And when you do that, you will get for absolutely free a link that will give you an electronic copy of my book, 7 Words to Jumpstart Your Love Life. It's a nice book. And I just recently put it out. It's not only available on Amazon on Kindle. I also did a hard copy. And you know why I did that? Because I can. That's why I did that. I don't know if anyone's going to buy it, because you can get the electronic copy for free. But if you want a hard copy of it, complete with, you know, pictures and everything else, you can get that from Amazon as well. Mm. And then there's another book, which it's not a freebie. You can go and buy this one. It's a niche book.
It's a niche
book. It's called My Husband Complains About My Cleaning. What Do I Do? Hint, it's not about cleaning. Mm. It's a book that has a lot of similar ideas to what we talk about and everything else, but it focuses on this question because we keep getting all these searches for my husband's complaining about my cleaning and it's driving me nuts. And what do I do? And so for those of you who may be watching this who are in that group, you can buy the book. Mm-hmm. It's available on Amazon. So check it out. Also, while we're on the topic of our website, let us mention that we have our
merch.
Our beautiful Couples Therapy in 7 Words mugs, what we're holding up, again, for those of you watching the video, mm-hmm. In the 15-ounce and 11-ounce sizes. And
right. With our beautiful logo on one side and our motto, Be Kind, Don't Panic, and Have Faith, on the other side.
Right. And I do want to mention, since I mentioned those of you who are viewing this, if you got this on a podcast platform, you are listening to the audio-only version. If you want to see us do this as well as hear us, you can go to a YouTube link, which will be provided in the notes along with this podcast, or you can find it a link to it on ctn7.com. And I especially want to put in a plug for that for this particular episode where we have Emily and Paul for reasons that we explain in the video, why we think it's especially worth watching us and watching them. So I think we've covered what we need to cover.
I think we have.
Without further ado, we're going to move on to the interview, and you'll hear Judy introducing our guests, and watch it all the way through. It is one of our longer podcasts. Really worth it, especially toward the end. That's when we really get into more about the belly dancing, folks. So, you can check that out toward the end, and we will see you on the other side.
Our guests today are Dr. Emily Basha and the Honorable Paul Johnson. Dr. Emily Basha is an author and licensed psychologist with a private practice in Scottsdale, Arizona. An expert witness in criminal, immigration, and civil courts, she worked on high-profile cases covering issues of domestic terrorism, capital offenses, and first-degree murder. In her clinical work, Dr. Basha specializes in mental illness, personal and collective trauma, addiction, grief and loss, as well as family and relationship dynamics. The Honorable Paul E. Johnson Jr. is the host of the Optimistic American podcast, whose goal is to create space in the news media for a positive and hopeful view of America. He has a significant background in business, politics, and government, and became the youngest mayor of Phoenix, Arizona at 30 years old. He has run several state campaigns for presidential candidates and is the CEO and co-founder of Redirect Health. Emily and Paul's collaboration in life and work marries their combined skills and backgrounds in clinical and forensic psychology, politics, and geopolitical issues. Their recent book is called Addictive Ideologies: Finding Meaning and Agency When Politics Fail You. Emily and Paul, welcome to Couples Therapy in 7 Words.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's our honor, really.
Well, we are delighted. And I have to say, in reading your book, thank you for providing us. It is a wonderful book. I'm going to start right out by just recommending it to all of our viewers and listeners, Addictive Ideologies. Emily, it's a page-turner, I have to tell you. I was fortunate to start it early enough in the day that you didn't cost me a night's sleep, but it would have, because I wouldn't want to put it down. And especially it's the part that really grabbed me was the part about your family's history, which is just fascinating. And I'm asking you, like, tell us, you know, what was that your family's experience in Saddam Hussein's Iraq in the late 60s, early 70s, certainly was a major shaper of how you work and what you do. And I'm really curious about that. And I have to add, please include how belly dancing fits into your life, because if that doesn't, you know, grab our listeners and say, wait a minute, you're talking about these awful things that are happening, and you're also including belly dancing in there and politics. How is that all that? Anyway, please, Emily, speak
to us. Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm happy to talk about all of those things. You know, Paul and I were really looking at how do we merge psychology and politics to help understand the political tension and divides that are happening, not only nationally, but also worldwide. And we analyzed and studied different forms of extremism, genocides across the world. And we saw that my family's story was really a rich case illustration and example to show how this can happen and groups of people can participate. And unfortunately, it's a horrific story of anti-Semitism, but it doesn't just have to be targeted towards the Jewish population, as we saw in the Rwanda genocide and the Cambodia genocide, the Bosnian genocide. So we saw that there were these trends and psychological processes that were happening, and we wanted to really analyze them and extract what is the connecting factor among all of these. And what we found was it's really addictive ideologies, and that people are surrendering and losing their self-agency and individuality to an ideology that could be exploited by any kind of leader during a vulnerable time, and giving some kind of promises, and that these can be addictive. And we talk about in our book and extract how that's possible. With my family story, what was really heart-wrenching was that it was neighbors, it was business partners, it was people that my parents were going to school with who were one day just turning on them. My father was 17 years old. He was riding his bicycle and he saw some commotion in this main square, Tahrir Square, actually just last year. It ended up being commemorating the 50th memorial year following these hangings. And also was the 50th memorial year that my grandfather was taken and disappeared. Now, during the rise of Saddam Hussein, there was a lot of propaganda against the Jewish population. And I think that they could have targeted any group. It was opportunistic because Jews owned land, Jews owned businesses, Jews had wealth, and they were affluent and had power at that time. And so it was convenient to really target them. And so it really happened overnight. We saw that this happened even decades earlier during what was called the Farhud, which was the violent dispossession, where Jews were also targeted. Many were killed. People were waving limbs in the air. One person even had torn the breast off of a Jewish woman. Many Jewish women were raped. And it was just violent, and it was in a short, brief period of time. The question that Paul and I are asking is, how does this happen? How do you have people who are your friends, your neighbors, your colleagues, your peers, your schoolmates, who can just in one day turn on you? And it's not that these are evil people inherently or innately. That is not the case. These are average people. And Paul and I argue that good and evil exist in all of us. And we have to recognize that and take responsibility for ourselves in order to really look at the path that we're choosing. So
I want to mention one of the things I said to Judy as I was reading the book, that I had no idea. And we're Ashkenazic Jews, right? Most of our listeners would know that from hearing us talk about Jewish stuff a lot. We're both Jews of Ashkenazic background. And I had no idea until I read your book that anything like genocide was happening in Iraq in the 1960s and 70s even. I had no idea about any of that. I knew, things were tough for Jews all over, but until I read about that, I didn't know it. And it is fascinating and horrifying, that phenomenon of friends turning on friends. That's what my limited understanding of what happened in Rwanda. It's what happened in Germany. Mm-hmm. It's what happens where there's genocide on.
But I also think Western Jews don't realize how far back the Iraqi Jewish community goes. We're talking about the Babylonian exile in 586 BCE. So yeah. It's not like you're Johnny come latelys and you came there at the beginning of the 19th century and you took over the country. I mean, it's deep rooted history of Jews in Iraq.
Yeah.
So, these neighbors that are suddenly turning on them, these are people that shared thousands of years of living together and coexisting.
Absolutely. Yes. We've been there since 500 BC. And as far as we know, even tracing back on my father's and my mother's side, we've been there for so many centuries. Mm-hmm. Paul and I looked at some of the common factors that also occurred in Europe during the time of the Nazi regime rising to power, and how they were able to really galvanize the minds of so many people to commit such horrific atrocities and just these violent acts towards humans, is that they really made the outgroup to be seen as the oppressor, and that the people believe that they were oppressed and victimized. And that really permitted this process of hate and vengeance and even some paranoia against them. Well, if I don't get them now, they're going to get me later. And it really became this psychology of tyranny in promoting these violent acts. So Paul did a lot of work in politics, and I think I'd like to bring him on to talk about that part and the processes, because he's really looked at reducing extremism in politics today. And I think that really links. And then I'm happy to talk more about the belly dancing and how I got into psychology.
Yeah, Paul, please. I was wondering, you know, if you want to address a little more about, like, what do you mean addictive ideologies? And of course, tell us, yeah, about your background in politics. I mean, most 30-year-old people are not mayors of major cities, for example. Tell us about that.
Well, I ain't 30 years old anymore, but yes, I was 30 when I became mayor. First, Emily's story is probably, it's so illustrative of the problem, and Emily does a great job of describing that. So I'm more than willing to let her occupy a major portion of this time. What I can tell you is that as mayor, as mayor, I dealt with racial issues. I dealt with oftentimes big divides in the community between the right and left. I had to deal with several mass shootings that happened in my community during the time that I was mayor. And I think Emily and I are both deeply concerned about these divisions that exist in America and around the world. Emily talked about that story that we're concerned about, or how does it happen? One of the immigrants that we had spoken to that had gone through the war in Bosnia, I think gave us a great example. He talked about, we know that Milosevic had put people inside of mass graves, and that we started in the United States as we were doing flyovers with NATO. We had on our show a General Wesley Clark. He talked about how we first began to identify that they had that they were killing people in mass. Well, in this one particular story, he talked about, not General Clark, but another immigrant, talked about how a group of American troops were coming up to a ditch where there were obviously hundreds of people that were in the ditch. There at the edge of the ditch were a couple of guys in backhoes and tractors, guys with shovels throwing dirt down in the ditch. None of them were soldiers. When they saw the American troops, they ran off. When the American troops came up to the ditch, the people they were throwing dirt on top of were still alive, right? There were children, babies inside the ditch. The question is, how does that happen? How can people get to that point? And it's something that when you look at genocides, and terrorism, and extremism, there's a connection that you'll find between all three. Emily's done a lot of evaluations of actual terrorists who have been engaged in terrorist acts. And what we found is that one of the connections to all of them is ideology. There's always an ideology that connects those groups. The second factor that's important is that those ideologies that turn violent always begin with an oppressed and an oppressor mindset, meaning that someone's a victim, they're a victim, and someone else is oppressing them. Now, what the ideology does is it actually becomes kind of a training ground or an ability to be able to give people a rationale for why things are happening, very simple rationale. But what that rationale does is it also helps individuals with the ability to feel like they're empowered, where they can win an argument. You know, we know psychologically that if you get into an argument with someone and you win the argument, it actually releases hormones, including adrenaline and dopamine, which begins to have an addictive feel inside the mind. It begins to make you feel that you're empowered. Well, that's part of what happens with the ideology. But what also happens is that as you begin to become more bought into it, you begin to isolate those people who care about you, who love you, who either don't want to hear your radicalism or that you don't want to hear their rationality. And so you begin to isolate and move away from them, and you move towards people who are more ideologically driven. Now, what then happens is key. You know, we talk a lot about the amygdala hijack, both in our book and in shows that we do. The amygdala hijack is this concept that all the optimistic parts of you, that where rationale comes from, where your creativity, your innovation, even your love comes from. It comes from the neocortex, the frontal lobe of the brain. What happens, though, is if I can terrify you, if I can make you worried that something bad is going to happen to you or to others, the amygdala actually hijacks that neocortex. And the only thing you can think about is fight, flight, or freeze. Believe me on this. I know this in politics. People in politics and the news know that very well. They know the power of the negative bias, and they use it to get what they want. So on, you know, our nightly news today, whether it's CNN or Fox or MSNBC, they're appealing to a group. And the way that they get you to watch tomorrow is to engage that negative bias, to make you ensure that you want to watch tomorrow to see how that solution or how that problem is being solved. But that begins to divide us a little more. I once in a presidential campaign, I had a pollster tell me, I will never forget. She said, look, here's our key. We have to get our base out. And to get our base out, we have to terrify them about the other side. So all yeah, these things can be
that idea leads, right?
Yeah.
You talk about that in the book. If it leads. Yeah.
And it creates a mindset that things are falling apart. Now, we think that the beginning point is to understand they're not falling apart, not here anyway. Right? We still have a lot of really good things, and we're not nearly as divided as we may oftentimes want to believe. But you have to start by knowing the truth. Now, we think there are political reforms that are necessary. We think that there are educational reforms that are necessary. But the thing that is most necessary is for you to gain agency over yourself.
Yeah, it sort of starts with each of us recognizing. One of the things I really enjoyed about your book, that emphasis, that recognition that it really, we all do have some power here. We often don't recognize it, especially when we're hijacked by our amygdalas. I'm curious if either of you are familiar with Jill Bolte Taylor and the stuff she's about. She's the, you may know her, the name of her famous TED Talk is My Stroke of Insight. She's a neuroscientist, a stroke in her mid-30s, took her about 8 years to get her left functions back. And she talks a lot about the very things you were saying that, you know, it's, I guess the left amygdala in particular is the one that we freak out with. And it's a necessary function, of course. It shuts down the neocortex because there's no time, you know, if a saber-toothed tiger is after you, it's no time to say, what an interesting saber-toothed tiger. You know, it's like, no, you have to fight, flee, or freeze. And that phenomenon, what she talked about, having been without her left hemisphere for years, and then getting the functions back, she talks about how different it was to live that way without that, call it a capability to panic. So she was living in this holistic place. That what's fascinating, what I find about her work, is she talks about how all those things are available simultaneously. So that yes, we can learn to feel the fear, you know, to have our particular, you know, quasi-ideological, I like to call them ideas rather than ideas. You can have ideas and still hold the possibility that even people who have opposite ideas are crazy and you have something to learn from them. And that involves having, she says, we're all four different people. One of them is the one that freaks out, but the other three are much more tied into each other. So I don't know, are you familiar with any of her stuff, or I highly recommend it if you're not.
I'm not personally familiar with her work, but I took her name down. Thank you.
I love to talk about it. That phenomenon that we're different people, I think, fits very nicely. You know, that each of us are different people, fits well with your ideas about agency.
Talked about that in the different personas of the self. You know, that there's the shadow, the hero, that there are these different personas of the self. I think it's interesting that, you know, talking about it as an identity construct or personality as being integrated holistically as a part of the self, that we can still connect to all these different sides. And I think Paul and I would agree that, yeah, the good and evil exist in all of us, the dark and the light. And we as individuals have that power to choose.
And, you know, it's interesting when I read your descriptions of working with people who were who had committed terrorist acts, for example. You know, I haven't done that sort of work. I've worked with lots of people who survived trauma over the course of my career. And one of the things I learned very early was have someone who has part of themselves that are self-destructive, that are, you know, they're cutting themselves, or which is often very different from suicidal, you know, ideology or ideation. But one of the things I learned early was you can't banish those parts because they have a reason for being there. And I think it's similar to recognizing, you know, it doesn't seem to work with folks who are addicted to an ideology to utterly reject what they're saying. You know, named Derek Black. I just heard that name yesterday. Somebody was telling us about that. He's a white supremacist, sort of the scion of a white supremacist family who went to college at, I forgot what's the name of the in Florida. He actually went to a very liberal college in Florida, one of the ones that Governor DeSantis is attempting to to turn into a right wing institution. But one of the things that happened to him there was people found out who he was and started to, you know, cancel him, we would say nowadays. And except for there were a few people, including a particular student who was an Orthodox Jew who had invited him for Sabbath. And he came.
Amazing.
And he started coming and seeing, and it was this very diverse bunch of people at that dinner. And he started realizing that he didn't immediately jettison his views. He just started to note that his views that he didn't realize were causing harm were causing harm.
And from reading about him, he didn't even, they didn't even bring up his background. They totally, you know, ignored that part of him and just treated him like they would treat anybody else. And he saw the friendship and the kindness that he experienced was so different from everything that all the beliefs that he held about Jews and other minorities.
So you know, there's a. I think that's one of the great stories. One of my favorite stories. I know I'm going to get the details of this wrong, but it was of a jazz singer who talked about becoming friends with a guy who was in the Ku Klux Klan, and
I read about that.
It's just a great story. And he said that, you know, that this Klan's member came in and he started telling him. He goes, you know, I really liked your jazz. He says, but I have to tell you. He goes, I'm a Ku Klux Klan member. And he goes, it's really hard for me to say that I like you. And he says, instead of telling him why it was wrong, he started asking him questions, trying to understand why he thought that way and what it was that drove him. And he tried to be understanding and he tried to listen to the things that had happened bad in his life. One day the guy comes in and he goes, hey, I want to give you my hood. He goes, I've given it up and I've stopped. And he goes, I enjoy it. He goes, well, he says, here's what you can do for me. He goes, bring in other friends. So one of the things he said later on in his life was that somebody complained and said, how can you have all these Ku Klux Klan members that are coming in to watch you and you allow them to be your friend? And he said, hey, I don't judge myself by who likes me. I judge myself by how many hoods I get. Right? And the key is this. I sociologically, politically, I can promise you this. Emily will have to give us the psychological reasons, or you both could give the psychological reasons. But when you try to take someone who is frightened, terrified, worried about what's happening to them, and you try to talk to them logically about why they're wrong, about why their construct isn't correct, why the facts that they have aren't correct, which, by the way, is how we're trying to deal with these problems today. We're saying, look, if we just put the right expert up and gave people the facts to all these conspiracy theories, it would fix it. And here's the answer. No, it won't. That will not fix it. You have to address the fear. And part of how you address the fear is many of these people find themselves to be invisible. Now, I am sometimes tough on the left on this issue. I mean, keep in mind, I was a Democratic mayor. I am totally bought into civil rights, equal rights, and human rights. But it's not lost on me that many of these people, you know, if you look at the average Trump supporter, the average Trump supporter was over 50 years old, white male, and had less than $2,000 in his bank account. Now, we can blame them for all the problems in the world if we want, but the reality is they're dealing with something. My guess is those things that they're dealing with are some of the issues that I support. Civil rights have had an effect on them, equal rights, human rights, the Me Too movement has had an effect on them. The economy and globalism had an effect on them. There's a sense that they began to become invisible, that they weren't seen, that they weren't allowed to speak up. It was inevitable. Someone would come along and say, I see you, and voice the same concerns that they had. And when they did that, they would follow them anywhere. It wouldn't matter what they did, what they said, what crime they broke. The fact that they were seen mattered to them. Now, again, I'm talking to you from a political standpoint. I know that theory works, that if you talk victim language to someone who feels like they're a victim, you begin to take their agency away from them, and you can use it as a platform to stand on. Politically, that's how it works. If we want to solve the problem, we're going to have to find a way to extend our hand over to the other side, to understand where they're coming from, to listen to them, and to find common ground.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so interesting, you know, and I want to segue a little bit toward, you know, we talk about couples therapy. I'm a couples therapist. And this is couples therapy in seven words. Our seven words, by the way, are be kind, don't panic, and have faith. Those are the seven words. And I wrote, actually, I'll put in a shameless plug for one of my most recent books.
Go ahead.
And in one of my most recent books, I had two chapters on ideas versus ideologies, talking a lot about the same stuff that you've been talking about, that notion of what happens when things become ideological, that it shuts us down to connection. I see it happening with couples a lot, especially in the last, 6 years, hopefully, that's been happening a lot where, used to be couples could have different, different sorts of political ideologies. I remember in 1960, my father voted for Nixon and my mother voted for Kennedy, and they just laughed about it. It wasn't like a grudge match, mostly they would vote for Democrats, but my father thought, who is Kennedy guy, this young, senator, and voted for Nixon because he was known, it was just interesting. And you couldn't, nowadays that doesn't happen so much. If one member of a couple is on one side and the other on the other, they often show up in an office of someone like me, and it's painful. It's really difficult. And you see often when it has turned ideological. So I am curious, one of the things you've written about is just ideas for, what do you do with loved ones? What do you do with family members, or yourself even, but especially family members, where somebody seems to have fallen into one of these addictive ideologies? How do you suggest people manage that?
Yeah, one of the things that we looked at is how obsessions are linked to these ideologies and how polarized people's perceptions and perspectives are taken. So I think your example was a good one, because they're probably not operating in that domain that is so polarized. They're probably able to have some really well thought out conversations. They're probably finding ways to connect on really key values that is helping to solidify the foundation of their narratives. So while they may have opposing narratives on some respects, there's still an agreement that on the foundation and the important values are, whether we respect each other's autonomy, whether, family above all, that, we're not going to be selfish and only thinking of our needs. We're going to be thinking of the needs of the group, and engaging in conversations where we're in disagreement is actually encouraged. And, I love that families have these debates around their dinner tables and really encouraging and shaping and modeling for their children. How do you do this? How do you debate and still share space and have a respectful dialogue and still disagree? And today, we're looking at safetyism really helping to really dominating in universities, and it's harming people's education because they're silencing these alternative perceptions or perspectives and voices, because they're not feeling safe to have these difficult discourses. And what is that really teaching people? It's also silencing peers and other students who may have differing opinions. And we know from so many different studies that diversity, it matters. Having a diverse range of opinions, diverse representation on boards, that's going to help make things more effective, that it's going to be more solution oriented. Other people from diverse perspectives are going to think about things that others aren't. So that the role isn't about homogeny or complete obedience, that everyone must conform, that's another form of extremism. And that's what Paul and I are arguing, that, you know, the alt-right is really another form of extremism compared to the politically correct authoritarianisms, and that there's really a danger that exists on both polarized ends. And so, you know, we were talking before about how it can be so simplified, and a leader or media or politicians can promote whatever agenda that they have and take advantage of some of these vulnerabilities that people might have at an individual level. But dehumanizing this outgroup, when you don't really know them, you don't spend time with them, you don't really try to understand where they come from, what their background is, how they came to their beliefs, how their worldview was shaped. I mean, this is all psychology. This is all what I do in forensic work. How did this person get to this point in their life? How many different wrong turns did they take to get to this place? And so it's important to be able to see if you're dehumanizing an outgroup and you're not really seeing them as part of this shared construct of humanity that we all exist in, that's dangerous, because all it takes is that next little step, that next little step. Paul and I discuss the process of radicalization, and I've worked with different youth who've been radicalized across different platforms and social media. There are certain inherent vulnerabilities, depression, anxiety, of course, mental health. If they've recently had a loss, if they're being bullied in school, they feel ostracized based on their gender or their race or their religion, or for whatever reason. It could be any kind of like a physical deformity or a defect, anything that gets amplified that they're being ostracized by. And this can have this buildup resentment, this psychological resentment. And what do they do with that? Where is their outlet? If they're not really given some pro-social means to be able to express their frustration or challenge the people who are rejecting them socially, and find a sense of belonging or a place that they really can feel some connection and buffers and protective factors and supports, they're going to be really at risk of being radicalized. And we're seeing this even on gaming platforms, not just like social media platforms, but they're all over. And it's really, really quite dangerous. We're seeing a rise of anti-Semitism. We're seeing aggrieved white males. A rise of violent acts. We're seeing an increase of mass shootings. I mean, there's so many different social incidents to be concerned about. And I think that really addictive ideologies in this process, I'm not trying to oversimplify something really complex, but I really do believe inherently that there is this function that it plays across all of those atrocities. So if we can,
Emily's point.
I'm sorry, Paul, I missed that.
I was just going to say, to Emily's point, I would say two things. You know, you almost have to create a separation between how you treat other people and then what we need to have from a societal standpoint to be able to make things work. In terms of the, Emily was the one who first tagged us as being like an addiction. And like an addiction, obviously, people, as they become addicted to the ideology, it becomes much more difficult to break. What we do know is that when you try to break that addiction by just simply telling them that they're wrong or trying to confront them with facts, you can get an adverse reaction. In fact, in some cases, they can become more violent from that. Those individuals, if they're your son or your daughter or your husband or your wife, start with listening. And then what the easier shift, instead of shifting them to an alternative political point of view, shift them to other goals that they have in their life. Because sometimes they're letting their other goals suffer. They're letting their family suffer, their job suffer, the other things that they care about. And you can find a shared space with them in those other areas. When you move to the social realm, I think the key is that you know, we believe in the free marketplace of ideas. The free speech works. Boy, it's messy. It's sometimes hard. It's sometimes harsh. It's sometimes difficult to deal with. But it's the only answer that we know that works in a free society. And what I found is that oftentimes, including me, in free speech, sometimes we put out dumb ideas. We put out things that don't work. But as long as speech is free, somebody else kind of corrects us. And the public begins to hear this mosaic come together, and they begin to recognize where the rational point is. From a societal standpoint, we're making a mistake when we try to close down one group, just like when we're dealing with an individual. Trying to close them down on an individual basis isn't going to be helpful to the discussion. At the end of the day, you know, that we talk about the seven ideals. Know the truth, which is the first one. The second one that is very important is treat people as an individual. You know, we're not going to fix this if we treat people as part of a group, whether that's the white patriarchy or, you know, the minorities that we believe are trying to harm us through whatever, what other means that you may think that they're trying to harm you through. Seeing people as an individual, that's a starting point. Recognizing our own culpability, that we have to be responsible for ourselves. We have to build strength through listening to adverse opinions and being willing to think about what it is that they're saying. And then finally, it's through trying to find a sense of meaning and belonging.
It's so interesting that, you know, often the attempt to talk someone out of it is playing exactly into what their fears are. It's confirming their fears. And that, right. You know, I find one of the hardest things, you know, I'm not sure I could have been that guy that invited, you know, the white supremacist to a Shabbos meal, you know, but that one of the hardest things to do often is to recognize that there's a basis for even the most awful of these ideological beliefs. And it's interesting when you talk about the process of trying to understand people. That fits in that when I talk about my bit about having faith, that's what I mean by faith. I'm not talking about religious faith per se, but the idea of having faith that we, you know, most people aren't crazy, even if it seems crazy. Most people, there's a reason why they get into these things. It's based on something that's real. And if acknowledging that is a start toward actually connecting with people. And I think you were going to ask about specifically anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. How do you do about anti-Semitism? Could you solve anti-Semitism for us in the next, you know, 30 seconds, please?
Yeah. You know, the Jewish community has played a very special role. And it's one that I think is very powerful. It's the role that lets us know that this can happen anywhere at any time. You know, I have Jewish friends who were German. I have one that I knew for a number of years who had a number on their arm, right? And she would talk to us about how it happened and what took place and what was taking place politically and how the political leaders work, which, by the way, sometimes is very terrifying when you compare it to what's happening to today, right? We can see similarities that are there. But in some cases, many of them thought, well, it was the Germans who had a problem. Well, when you go to Iraq, people thought that it was the Arabs that had a problem. When you go to Bosnia, it's the Muslims who thought that it was Christians that had the problem. The point is this, any of us can have that problem. And what the Jewish community helps us do is they never let us forget. But we're not just remembering the Holocaust in Germany. We're remembering that this type of thing is a human condition that we have to always be concerned about. We always have to be alert on. And we also have to recognize why it is that Western liberal democracy works. You know, in our society, we start with the idea that every individual is worthy of dignity. Now, we take that for granted. We hear that, and it almost sounds like it's just a slogan. But the reality is that's not how every society sees it. And that's certainly not how we've seen it throughout history. Oftentimes, people are seen as part of a collective or part of a group. And candidly, oftentimes, they don't matter individually. But in our society, we believe every single human being matters. And in many ways, the most powerful thing that our government ever did, we've done amazing things. We built bridges and dams and roadways and even took people to the moon. But the most powerful thing that our government did is it empowered the individual over itself. It said that these are rights that people have. We should be very concerned about when the right and the left, the far left and the far right, I should say, because I don't think that the actual right and left ever buy into that. But the far right and the far left do not buy into the power of the individual. They see things in terms of groups, whether it's class warfare or racial warfare. And the challenge with that is it stops gauging people, as one of my favorite men said, we stop judging them by the content of their character. We start seeing them as part of a group. And again, the Jewish community, I think the reason that it's so powerful is because anti-Semitism, from the beginning of time, you can just see it over and over again. So they're the best ones to remind us. They're the best ones to tell us the story and to tell us what it is that we ought to be looking for the warning signs on.
Yeah, I actually just want to be able to quote Paul's father on this. He's such a wise man. And he said, you know, there's never anyone north of you. If you believe that there's someone, if you believe that there's someone south of you, then there must be somebody north of you. They're only east and west. And I think Jews historically have been seen as either colonizers, well, most recently since the birth of Israel, as having white privilege, or alternatively discriminated against as being immigrants or an inferior race. Either way, it's like they're superior or inferior, no matter what, we can't do anything right. But just as Paul was saying, it's a form of bigotry. And this is leading propaganda for hate crimes. And you can replace Jews with any other group. You can say white males now. You can say women minorities. You could say other immigrants. You can just replace it with another name. But that form of bigotry is what's really dangerous, as promoting the discrimination and any kind of extreme form of justification of an ethnic cleansing. So as long as we demand to be seen as individuals, and as long as we see others as individuals, then we can protect the shared humanity. And it's the only way we can fix this problem. I realize I never finished the story about my father. I got off on a tangent. So he's 17 years old.
I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. Right.
He's 17 years old. He's riding his bicycle. He sees this commotion in the town square. It's called Tahrir Square. And he sees, as he's approaching, that there are men on gallows. There are nine males, two of whom are minors. They were only 17 years old, and they were all Jews. They were all accused of being spies for Israel. It was what was called a Mickey Mouse trial. It lasted days, at the most a week. And really, they were the government was just handpicking people that they wanted to be able to hang in the town squares as a form of propaganda for the community. So when my father came up there, he saw that there was jeering, cheering, people are dancing in the street. They showed it on the news later that day, that Arabs were celebrating these hangings. And he was terrified. He quickly went home. My mother, on the other hand, she went to school. She saw that there were people in front harassing her. And again, these were her schoolmates. And it all of a sudden became just a terrorizing time for the Jewish community. My mother's father disappeared. He was last being seen, taken by some government officials, being pushed into an unmarked vehicle. We know now that it was part of the Ba'athmith party. He was taken to an underground jail that they called the Palace of No Return, because anyone who went in never was heard from again. We never received any confirmation of my grandfather's death, but what we know is that he was tortured and terrorized. And my mother and her family stayed in Baghdad for another 6 months, hoping that he would be released, but he was never released. And my mother even went to one of the security official offices of the Ba'ath Party demanding that her father be released. And here's a young Jewish woman. There was just so much courage and bravery and hardship and suffering and trauma and terror that was all intermixed at that time. You know, my parents today, if you talk to them, they never vilify Arabs. They never demonize Muslims. In fact, my mother will tell you one of her best friends was a Muslim girl. And when my mother was having to escape, they all went through different routes. She went to her and they never exchanged any words, but they just knew. And they sat with each other and cried because they knew that they would never have that friendship again. It's just, it's so sad what happens to humanity. And I think, like, look at their courage and look at how my parents, all that they suffered, and it would be justified. And I work with so many trauma survivors. It would be justified for them to be so angry and hateful. But, you know, you're swallowing the poison. You're swallowing the poison, hoping that the other person would die. It's just toxic. Yeah. That's only going to harm you. And, you know, let them be a model for this prescription that we're saying, hey, if they can do it, any of us could do it. It's possible. Viktor Frankl is also just such an immense model. He never vilified the Nazi guards. He only spoke about them with sympathy. He said, yeah, there were bad ones. There were mean ones. There were ones that would want to terrorize you and traumatize you. But there were also ones who really didn't want to be there. And you know who they were. And there are different degrees of people.
That's, and you know, a lot of what the story in your book was so inspiring was very much that the examples that you gave of your parents and their ability to come through horrendous things and not be hateful. And, you know, you use yourself in there. I really enjoy that. Folks who can't see this, you mention your own appearance because you look like an Arab because you are an Arab. And you look like a Jew because you are a Jew. Absolutely. And isn't that interesting? Like, so it's not a dichotomy, is it? It's like, oh, turns out there are Arab Jews. Who knew? You know, exactly. Go figure. On that note, I want to bring it back around, oddly enough, to belly dancing. And I'll tell you why I say that. It's almost a spoiler, but it happens in the first chapter, you know, in the introduction, I think, of your book, where you mention, you talk about this person who was a belly dancer and then reveal that it's you. And I was so intrigued by your description of veils. And, you know, what I immediately thought of was the concept of code switching, which, you know, I think Black people are more familiar with than I am, but Jews are familiar with that one too. We don't talk the same way in certain, you know, when it's a Jewish only group, we're not talking the same way we are when it's a mixed group. And I'm really curious about, I don't know if you want to tie that into your description of veils and belly dancing, but please tell us about how you got into belly dancing and what it means in your life.
Yeah, so I was born in Canada. So my parents benefited from Operation Nehemiah and Operation Ezra. And so that's when the Americans were really supporting these refugees in surrounding countries in the Middle East to have asylum and move to Israel. And so there were different safe houses in countries nearby. My mother and some of her family members escaped through Turkey. My father escaped through the Kurdish mountains with the support of the Kurds. They were trafficked into Iran at the time, which was before the revolution. And then Israel helped them to relocate. And then they were both in Israel. So I was born in Canada with many privileges of being North American. My parents, mostly my mother, wanted to name us with American names to help us pass and be assimilated into American culture. So she was trying to prevent the trauma that she had experienced. And it was really important to my mother that we were not exposed to this political violence. And she tried her best to assimilate us. And of course, as you know, as parents, the more you try to push your child in one direction, the more curious they become of like, well, what are you hiding from me over there?
So you can play hockey or you could take up belly dancing, right?
So I decided I want to know about my Arab heritage and my Arab identity. And it was so connected to my Jewish ancestry that I didn't see them as that they were separated. I saw them as inextricably linked. And so I was permitted to venture, but only so far. So at the age of 20, I decided to give up all my possessions, drop out of art school. And my mission was to backpack the Middle East and work on my Arabic skills and survive in a way as a nomad and learn about my Arab roots and heritage. So I went through Egypt and Sinai, Israel, Jordan. I went down into Africa. And it was really remarkable. I was there for a year and I had very little income. So I would find different places to work. And that's when I really started to study and embrace belly dancing. And I went to Cairo and was dancing with one of the prestigious choreographers of her time, Raya Hassan. And I have to say, growing up, belly dancing was a part of our family gatherings. We would have bar mitzvahs and bat mitzvahs, and somebody would play Arabic music. And then all of a sudden, my mother would break out into these like beautiful belly dancing moves, and my aunt. And then the men would suddenly like get down on their knees and start like jeering and clapping for them and making some calls for them. And it was just a beautiful display of dance and culture and celebration of heritage. And so this was innate. I feel like for me, it was just a matter of reconnecting with my grandmother, Nana Madu. She would always play.
I have to mention, when I was a kid, I went to hundreds of bar mitzvahs, so did you. Never saw belly dancing at any one of them. I wish I had.
You could always tell the Mizrahi Jews, because immediately the hands started doing this.
The hands and the hips follow, yeah.
You just couldn't keep them down. It was like, ooh. And it was just so beautiful, and these sensuous moves, and just knew who had that background.
See, the Buffalo, exactly. I grew up in Buffalo. The Buffalo Jewish community didn't have a lot of Mizrahi Jews. That I knew. But yeah, you were in a more diverse area.
Well,
yeah.
Klezmer music is amazing. It's so beautiful and danceable. Yeah.
Not so much belly danceable, but danceable.
I want to get another topic. Yeah. How did you two meet?
Finish the belly dancing. And then yes, tell us about that.
So for me, I grew up with it. I have a picture. I was 2 years old and my mother dressed me as a belly dancer. I even had little finger cymbals. And I said to my mother, I showed her the picture and said, "And you wondered why I became a belly dancer?" I remember my grandmother, whenever she would come to visit us, and she would play some of these Egyptian soap operas on TV, and they would always have a belly dancer appearance on them. And it was really interesting because it became one of the tactics Saddam Hussein used for whenever he was coming on to make some kind of like a presidential appearance on TV. They always had a belly dancer perform first to get everyone's attention. Wow. And then he would come on. So, the belly dancers were just adored and loved. And it's such a interesting conflict because it's not something that you would typically envision, a Middle Eastern woman with maybe some kind of deprived rights or privileges to be doing such a sensuous dance. But really, it's so cultural and there is a beauty to it. And so much of it, I think, is misunderstood by Western culture and society. And that was also a reason why Paul and I decided, this is an unveiling. For me, it was a risk with my professional identity as a psychologist to do. And I thought, well, this feels right, because now I'm controlling the narrative surrounding it. and I'm doing it with honor. And there's heritage and there's culture and there's ancestry. And it is connected to also my training and appreciating and understanding Arab heritage. Mm. So this also transforms to the work that I do in people who are charged of terrorism or extremism or have some kinds of extremist beliefs and are Muslim, that I'm seen as a cultural expert as having had that experience speaking Arabic and also having traveled through the Arab world, understanding their values and mores and roles, gender roles, all of those things become important.
So indeed, how did the two of you get together? Because that you didn't mention, I don't think you, that was in the book that I recall. So I was really curious. How did you get together?
You want to tell the story, Emily, or do you want me to?
Oh, I'll tell it. That's fine. All right. So I was approaching 40 and I was at a stage in my life thinking, I want to have a child and I'm single. And at the time I'm living with my parents, which is not uncommon culturally to have an enmeshed family. Started my private practice and I'm starting to think about, okay, what are all the different ways that I might be able to have a child or be a single mother by choice or raise this child in with my parents in our home. And so as I was thinking about all these multitude of options that we have nowadays with technology and science and fertility opportunities, I kept thinking of Paul. I was saying, well, of all the people that I know, who might I ask to maybe be a donor or participate in this with me? And Paul just kept coming up in my mind. And I had to really seek my own truth in that. And I had known Paul for 10 years. He was a mentor of mine. He really was such a strong advocate and supporter, encouraged me to go into private practice and open my own business. He really helped me become involved in politics and with all my work that I did in research with immigration. He was right there supporting me. And so I joined every single possible like political business mentoring running group Paul had of his. I was a big fan. And so having known him for 10 years and his family and his community, I really had to ask myself, well, okay, what's going on for me? I'm Paul is like the only person that is coming to my mind. Once I realized I was in love with him, there was no turning back. It was like the bubble burst and it was like, that's it. Once it's seen, it can't be unseen. And I worked so hard at suppressing it. And once I knew, I actually held it in for several years. Paul was not available. And I never wanted to damage or destroy that relationship. As soon as Paul became available, I said, okay, we're having lunch. And I said, you promised me a lunch when I turned 40 that you would tell me how great the 40s are going to be. Paul is 20 years older than me. And it was just so unconventional in so many ways that I really had to work through a lot of my socialization and even religious values and other values. I had to push through all of them to really see, well, what was my truth? And it took a lot of internal work. So I pitched it. I pitched it to Paul in the way that he taught me to pitch a business proposal, which is align with the person, know what their values are, and give it as an offering. And I literally said, Paul, I have a proposal for you and it meets all of your values. Think the unthinkable, change the world and have a blast. Will you have a baby with me?
Okay, so I have to say something here. So so we're on a hike, right? And a friend of ours had helped us set up the date. And so it's our first date. So we're going up the mountain. It's during COVID, during that period of COVID. And on the way up, she gives me this pitch. And I said, you know, Emily, I haven't dated for a while. I said, the way we used to do this is you went out for a little while, and then maybe you got engaged, and then maybe you got married, and then you talked about having a baby. And she said, well, I don't have time. She said, didn't tell me she was in love with me or anything else. She just said, this is what I want to do. I said, well, I'll tell you what, we'll do another hike. So we go out for another hike a couple of days later, and I'm thinking I'm going to talk, that I've got her talked out of it, because I'm telling her I'm 20 years older than you. I don't, you know, you should maybe get somebody who's more age appropriate. I'm going through the whole deal with her. And when we got back down to the bottom, she said, okay, I have one more thing I have to tell you. I said, okay, what's that? She goes, not only do I want to have a baby with you, but I'm in love with you. I paused for a minute. I said, okay, we're going to have to do some more hikes. So
I said, if you're really thinking seriously about this, I don't want to deceive you, and you have to know something. I'm in love with you. I've been in love with you for a long time.
Mm. By the way, it's been one of the greatest gifts of my life. We have a little 2-year-old girl today, and oh my gosh, I am now 63, but it has made 63 awesome. It's really an enjoyable thing. I've had 2 sons in my past. I have 14 grandchildren, but there's something special about a little girl.
Wow. Well, mazal tov. That is just that's an amazing story. Wow. I think we can end on that note.
That's a good note to end on.
Thank you so much for doing this. This has just been delightful. And please tell people how they can find your book and find out more about you, your website, stuff like that.
Your podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead. Okay, our book is Addictive Ideologies. You can buy it on Amazon. We have it all on so many different platforms that you can buy it on. So you can just look it up online. And also our podcast, Optimistic American. Paul has amazing guests that he also invites. And him and I do co-host a number of different shows where we're really bridging psychology and politics, where we do a deep dive into a lot of what we had talked about today.
Well, thank you so much. And we will put up those links, in the notes that go along with this podcast. I do want to mention, for folks who are listening and not viewing it, you can view any of our podcasts on YouTube. And if you look at the notes on the podcast platforms that just have the sound, you will see the link to the YouTube for this. And I hope you will do that, because it's I mentioned the fact that, Emily looks like an Arab Jew, and that's just that's worth looking at the video just for that. So that we
have. I also am told I look like Barbara Streisand. So I also get
Barbara
that.
Streisand.
We have that link.
You also get a good view of a Goya.
Yes, indeed. Referring to yourself. And Judy looks like Barbara Streisand, also, for folks who don't know that. So anyway, worth checking out the video. Thank you again so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ruth and Judy. Thanks for having us.
Welcome back. That was quite the interview. They are quite a couple, and I just love that story.
I love that story as well. And, hadn't heard the story of how they got together.
I know.
That wasn't in the book.
No.
And that's
that's so funny.
They're really a neat couple.
They are a neat couple.
Really enjoyed that.
And, the work that they do.
It is important work.
It is.
Yes, indeed.
So we hope you enjoyed that podcast. And if you did, good. Tell your friends about us, share us, like us, follow us, do all those things that people do with podcasts.
Yeah. Give us a 5-star rating and, put in a review and things like that. Mm-hmm. And also, we didn't include a listener question in this particular topic.
We didn't have time for a question.
But if you would like to, that's usually your line. Why don't you give that line?
Okay. So if you have a listener question that you would like us to read on the air, you can write to us. You go to our website, ctn7.com, and send us your listener question. And if you would like to be a guest on our podcast, you can also suggest yourself or somebody else that you know. And you can do that by going to ctn7.com.
That's the one. That's the number 7, ctn7, mm-hmm. Like couples therapy in 7 words.
Right.
Great. And let's just put in another plug for our books that we have. We have Reigniting the Spark, Why Stable Relationships Lose Intimacy, and How to Get It Back. That came out about 3 years ago, in time for the pandemic.
Yep. And then the latest one is It's Not About Communication, Why Everything You Know About Couples Therapy is Wrong.
Indeed. And there's a couple of other little bonus booklets you can get if you search for Dr. Bruce Chalmers on Amazon.
Yes.
You will find it.
And so, until next time,
remember, be kind,
don't panic,
and have faith.